Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Voices for Change 2.0, the only podcast that focuses on mental health while mixing in movies, music, books, sports, and pop culture. Here are your hosts, Rebecca and Joe Lombardo.
Hey, Dr. Joe.
Hey, good morning, and welcome to Voices for Change 2.0. It's just me right now. Joe is on the phone with our esteemed guest. She's having a little bit of difficulties with the Blog Talk format, but we will get with her as soon as possible. So you just have the pleasure of my company for just a few moments. Just to give you a little bit of an update on personal stuff, my petition actually hit over 100 signatures and is well on the way into 200 signatures. You can find it on www.voices-for-change.net. And the petition asks that students be required to take a mental health awareness course. And I really hope that I can get this moving because I think it's an important thing. I think, you know, I'm talking about everything from autism to Asperger's to ADD to bipolar disorder, you know, Down syndrome, Tourette's, the whole spectrum. I want kids to learn about all of it. So hopefully we can get this moving. Again, visit our website, or you can also visit www.rebeccalombardo.com. Just a moment. Let me get the update here. How are we doing, honey?
Scott is going to call her now to hopefully get her connected in.
Okay.
All right. Have her in a Hello? Few minutes.
Good morning, Dr. Zazio.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, we're doing okay. I'm so sorry for all the problems.
Hey there.
Oh, it's no trouble. I just wasn't sure what to do. Fortunately, I had your phone number.
Thank God.
thankfully for that. You know, we really, really appreciate you being here with us this morning. I know that you're in California and it's very early for you, so we just want to say thank you very much for being here.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, no problem.
Thank you for taking the time.
Of course.
So I'm just going to go over my introduction for you briefly so the guests know who we are with today.
Mm-hmm.
We are extremely excited to be chatting with this fantastic guest. Over the last few years, I've developed an immense amount of respect for her. Most people are familiar with Dr. Robin Zazio from the TV show Hoarders, but she also has her own private practice where she helps many people with OCD and anxiety. We're honored to have her on the show today, and good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being on the show with us, Doc. My wife has watched you for years and years and speaks highly of you. I catch the show here and there. I have a hard time with some of the people.
It's not so much the people. Well, Joe will often come home at dinner time. And I'll be watching an episode, and I'm sure you'll agree that some of the episodes are difficult to watch at dinner time. So
sure.
he kind of avoids the episodes, and then we both have a little bit of an issue with some of the animal episodes.
Yeah,
those are hard for us because it's got to be hard.
And it's heartbreaking seeing the people living in those conditions. You know, I mean, my heart breaks for them because, you know, I know they're going through a lot, and, you know, you see them and you want to help them, you want to make them feel better, and to see them in that kind of state, you know, and you're sitting at home watching it on TV and you don't know what to do, you know?
Yeah. Frustrating.
Yeah.
Well, if you don't have any questions for us, I know you have a podcast of your own, so you're sort of a seasoned pro. So if you don't have any questions for us, we'll go right into ours.
Yep, sounds good. I'm ready.
Okay, great. So obviously you're well known for the show Hoarders, but your private practice is in California. Would you like to talk a little bit about your practice and your specialties?
Of course, of course. Are we rolling now?
We sure are.
All right. Well, yeah. So I am in California. I'm the owner and director of the Anxiety Treatment Center located in Sacramento. And we help people overcome anxiety disorders. You know, most of the people that come our way are pretty debilitated. Anxiety disorders represent the largest mental health population in the United States, and at the same time, they are the most underrepresented in terms of treatment and care that they receive. And we don't really know why this is. I think that so oftentimes people think, oh, well, I have anxiety. I know what that's like, so I can treat people with anxiety disorders without realizing that it's a disorder. And, of course, I'm known for my work on hoarders, and that's a whole different level in terms of the difficulty that people are experiencing and the impact in their lives. But it's really a very, very trained, focused treatment in order to help people reclaim their lives. So we have intensive outpatient where people will come for several hours per day, anywhere from 3 to 5 days per week, and then also have a private practice in which people for less severe symptoms can come for treatment to get, you know, just weekly sessions to kind of help them along.
Right.
You know, I've often said to Joe when watching hoarders, God, I wish I could find a doctor like you or any of the other doctors on the show, because I personally, aside from bipolar disorder, I also have social anxiety and agoraphobia. And I don't know how much you know about my past, but I was diagnosed at 19, had a recent suicide attempt actually in 2013. So all of those things combined, I've often said, I wish I could find a doctor that is so amazing with people as the doctors on the show, because it's, how do I even say it? It's like you don't want to give up, and you're treating the person, you know, and you treat them with such respect regardless of their, you know, station in life or what, how bad the condition is, or even how they treat you at times, you're still so respectful to them. And I would imagine that you have an amazing practice, an amazing number of people that visit your private practice just because of that. I mean, you have a way with people, and I've always admired that about you.
Well, thank you. That's very, very kind. And I think the thing to remember is that the people that you're seeing on TV are really suffering, and mm-hmm. they're scared. And when people are scared, they're going to react. And that's a lot of what you're seeing, is that individuals who are struggling with hoarding disorder, who are in a crisis, and they're being sort of corralled into having to take action or something pretty catastrophic happening, whether it be losing their house, their children, another loved one, because perhaps the partner is saying, I can't live like this, and if this is your one opportunity. And so they have, you know, conceded to us coming, but it's not under typical circumstances that we would normally see when someone comes to our office, in that they are feeling that desperation and they are wanting that help. And so the reception is much warmer than when someone is in crisis and they're doing something because they have to, but not necessarily because they want to. So we have to understand that anybody who is suffering terribly, that their reactions can be very different. I mean, even if you have someone, let's say, that has depression, and, you know, somebody is coming in saying, you can't live your life like this. You can't be sleeping all day long. You can't not eat. This is unacceptable, that they could still react in a very threatened way, because what they know and what they're feeling in the moment feels very sort of what we call egocentric, meaning it's their experience, and it may not feel comfortable per se, but it's what they know. So when someone is saying, you can't do this anymore, this is unacceptable, you're really sort of putting somebody in a corner like a lion who's going to react.
Right. They're backed into a corner. That's an excellent description, and I hadn't ever looked at it that way, and that really, really just completely sums it up.
It resonates.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, and I think too, Rebecca, you know, your candid revealing of, you know, some of the things that have happened to you and a suicide attempt in 2013, I think it's so important that we all remember that as human beings, it's very instinctual to survive, to live. And if you imagine, and this may sound like a silly example, but if you imagine you had never seen water before and you were thrown into a pool, you wouldn't just sink down to the bottom and look around and say, wow, what's going on? Instinctually, you would swim to the top, right?
Right.
So when you talk about being in a place where you wanted to die, that's not human instinct, which really speaks to the level of despair that you were in. And that's the disorder. The disorder caused you to feel something that is not humanly instinctual. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
So you, but it was your experience, and it was real, and it was a place in which you felt that there was no out, and so you reacted to that. And so when we're dealing with people who are struggling with hoarding disorder, it's very similar. So when people are looking, saying, how could they or how could you? Well, that's the disorder. And so it makes sense,
right,
if you understand the disorder, how they could be living in some of those circumstances, because that's their real experience.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Hey, Dr. Zazio, you're kind of leading into my question here. Most mental illness is weighed down by a stigma of some type. Often people will use OCD as a punchline of a joke. Can you help people, our listeners, understand how debilitating it can actually be?
Absolutely. So, you know, we have in our lobby several flyers, one which is titled, I'm so, with lots of O's, OCD. And then it goes down to really help destigmatize OCD, because I think that OCD is a very glorified, if you will, way of, or a more acceptable, if you will, anxiety disorder, because oftentimes it's categorized by people that are very perfectionistic. They like order, symmetry, you know, things done in a certain way. And so that seems very much more acceptable than some of the other anxiety disorders, if you will, or symptoms. And I say that because I don't mean that as it being acceptable or not acceptable. Again, it just is. Mm-hmm. But I think that people oftentimes want to connect with somebody else. And so if you're saying, you know, I just cannot stand touching my shoes, I've got to wash my hands afterwards, and that's part of my OCD, someone else says, oh, I'm the same way, I'm so OCD myself, without realizing that, no, you just don't want to touch your shoes without washing your hands afterwards. It doesn't have to be OCD. And OCD
right.
is an incredibly, incredibly disabling condition that robs people of their lives. I have seen people whose hands are completely bloodied because of hand washing for hours at a time that have caused dryness and cracking. That's very, very serious. I've seen people who are terrified to eat something because they're afraid it could cause them to be ill and contaminated, and they have a feeding tube. So, you know,
wow.
it's we all have that human condition of knowing what anxiety feels like. But just because we know what anxiety feels like doesn't mean that we can connect with somebody at their level. And so this is why I do so much promoting of proper awareness, because people with anxiety disorders are oftentimes invalidated, because frequently people are saying, I can relate. Oh, I do that same thing, without just listening to their struggle and the impact and saying, wow, that's got to be really tough, without feeling like they need to connect. I know what it's like to be orderly. I know what it's like to have things in a certain way, and wanting every morning when I walk into my office for everything to be neat and tidy. But at any point, I don't say to a perfectionistic client, oh, I can relate, because I can't relate. I'm not going to see a therapist because I like things in a certain way. I just like things in a certain way. Do you see what I mean?
Right.
So we're talking about symptoms that escalate to a degree where somebody's having to go see a therapist, and that takes them at a different level.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, people are very flip about, you know, OCD, and they don't take into account, you know, components of it like the compulsive part, you know, where, you know, you feel like you need to touch the doorknob 83 times before you can go through the door, you know, different things like that, you know, and just they don't grasp it, you know, and they'll say, oh, I'm so OCD about this. And you just want to grab them by the shoulders and go, no, you're not. You
know? Right. Yeah, and if we even talk about depression, you know, someone who says, I can't get out of bed. I just feel so incredibly depressed. And frequently seeing loved ones or hearing about loved ones or family members saying, well, I feel down too. Don't you think that there's days where I don't want to get up and I don't want to leave, you know, the home? But I do, excuse me, but I do. And, you know, you just need to get up. You just need to do it, without realizing that depression is something greater than just feeling sad or blue or not feeling like you want to get up.
Exactly. And I've often looked at self-harm as an obsessive compulsive disorder, which is something that I've, you know, struggled with for a better part of 20 years, so I know exactly what that feels like, and I look at that as, I don't know if everyone that experiences it the same way as I did, but when I was, you know, I have 3 years and
it's
8 or 9 months, I think, clean now,
yeah.
But when I was in the midst of that, it was a constant, it's running through my mind over and over and over again. I would get images of what it would look like when it was done and just things like that. You know, I had songs I would play. You know, I had certain instruments, I guess you could say, the whole thing. And it was a well thought out process, and it was thought out again and again and again and again, and I obsessed over it. And it wasn't until this last incident in 2013 that I finally stopped. But I understand, you know, OCD, at least I've never actually had a doctor tell me, yes, self-harm is an obsessive compulsive disorder, but that's the way I've always looked at it.
Yeah, and, you know, typically when we're talking about self-harm behaviors, we're not necessarily referring to it as a symptom of OCD, as oftentimes we're looking at, while it can definitely have some obsessional qualities, that it's really more based in distress tolerance or intolerance and the difficulty regulating emotions and oftentimes, and again, Rebecca, you could speak to this, but when people are engaging in self-harm behaviors or cutting behaviors, it's usually this incredible amount of pain and inability to release that pain, and so turning to ways that you feel sort of metaphorically, if you will, it will release that pain, and of course it doesn't. And you've obviously figured that out, that you know, I always talk about, you know, kind of the definition of insanity. You keep trying the same thing and it's not working. So at one point, you've got to start doing something different. And behaviors absolutely serve no purpose in the long run. So everything that we're trying to do is to give people skills and tools and the ability to heal that offers long-term results. So if we jump back into hoarding disorder or hoarding behaviors, it is never, ever about a cleanup, ever. It is always about helping somebody to understand the contributing factors to the behavior, loss, trauma, or other issues, and helping them to develop that insight to prevent that behavior that has led to the disorder and the chaos in their lives. And, you know, going under, you know, deep down to say what is driving this behavior is always the key. And as you know, it's, you know, if you've got an alcoholic or a drug addict, it's not just about you need to stop doing that. And once you stop doing that, your life is going to come back together again. What is driving that behavior? Something's causing it. People do things for a reason. And it's so interesting because when we go back to OCD behaviors, people will say when they come into my office, I'm afraid of doorknobs, or I'm afraid of, you know, holding a knife because of images that I might harm someone else. Well, you're not afraid of the knife. You're not afraid of the doorknob. You're afraid of what that will mean. So that would mean harming someone else inadvertently, or what is on the doorknob that would cause you to get sick. So it's always about the outcome. And so we have to get at the feared outcome in any condition so that then you can work towards resolution.
Which is why whenever you're doing one of the shows, when the person who is involved in the hoarding behavior just says, just throw it all out, it's fine, just throw it all out.
Right.
You can't just go with that because you have to find out why it was all there to begin with. And if you just take it all away, I've heard you say on many times that the next time that you come back to that house, it's going to be hoarded again.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, the statistics are not very promising. About 10% on the average are able to maintain the progress. Conversely, 90% are not. And I think that there are reasons for that, which is where we started this conversation, and that is making sure that people are getting proper treatment. And we see in so many cases, and I get many, many calls from individuals who are saying that, you know, I just want to go while my loved one is at work and start throwing stuff out, and that doesn't work. It's not about throwing out the stuff. It's about helping them to get to a place where they can recognize that the behaviors are destructive both to themselves and those that they love. And that's not always easy because the disorder inherently prevents insight.
Right, yeah. Right.
Well, at this point, we're going to take a little break.
We will be right back with you. We are going to go out with David Hernandez, Beautiful.
The Father in the sky, and they're starting to align. I see you passing by, and we're slowing down the tide. Now my love is flashing by, all I see is flashing lights. Cause you're right here by my side, can you feel it come alive? If this were a love song, would you be mine? Cause I just can't get you off of my mind. And I think about you all day and night. So I wrote you a love song, wrote you a love song. Baby, you're beautiful. I think you're beautiful. think you're beautiful.
Welcome back to Voices for Change 2.0. We are glad to have you with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with us.
Of course.
And
no better way.
Welcome once again to Dr. Robin Zazio of the TV show Hoarders.
And also her private practice, which, forgive me, is the Anxiety the name of
Anxiety
your practice
Treatment
again?
Center, located in Sacramento.
That's right.
Anxiety Treatment Center.
Yes. Got it now. Okay.
So,
when did you first learn about the show Hoarders? Did they approach you, or was it sort of like an open call kind of thing? Or
yeah, it was about, I want to say, 7 years ago. They were in season two, and I got a random call from one of the producers letting me know that they had heard about my work and wanted to chat with me a little bit further about joining their team. And I had done some media work previously just in terms of various live shows and just talking about anxiety disorders and treatment and that kind of thing. But Hoarders was the first show of its kind to really showcase what this condition is. And, of course, there had been other shows, copycat shows, if you will, that came on board because it was clearly a fairly sensational representation of an anxiety disorder that just seems so confusing. And so it really captivated people because we, I think, historically can all now, as we look at the show, say, oh my gosh, I remember when I was a kid driving and seeing a house that had a lot of stuff, and now I realize that it was somebody struggling with hoarding behaviors or hoarding disorder. And we even see that today. Most people can't drive, and I know even I experienced that. We live in a nice gated community out in the hills, and there are two houses that we drive past that are hoarded. And you don't really think about it necessarily, or I never really thought about it until I started to specialize in hoarding disorder, and now I kind of go, oh, look. And so the show is one that really offers people a chance to regain their lives, because if you guys have noticed, it's quite a team that comes out between a therapist, between a crew to organize getting the stuff out. And there are so many layers upon layers of things that people don't even realize between the crews, the trucks, all the expenses associated with supplies and taking things to landfills and getting in auctioneers. It's just an incredibly huge production, and I don't mean for TV, if you will, but in the real world. Those are all the same things that in a crisis situation we would have to do, and people just don't have the resources to be able to do that. So the show has really offered countless people opportunities at reclaiming their lives that they might not otherwise have.
Yeah, it's quite an undertaking. You know, you're watching the show and you see a fleet of trucks come pulling up and all these people come pouring out and you're like, wow.
Yeah, it's so funny because over the years I've sort of I've spoken with both Matt and Corey on Twitter a few times and Corey on Facebook, and it's so funny. I had gotten to the point where, you know, when the trucks came, if they hadn't introduced who was coming yet, I'd say, oh, Matt, it's Matt. Matt's coming. Or, you know, with the truck, oh, it's going to be Corey. And, you know, it was just so funny because it was either the I don't know if I should mention the company, but it was the one junk company, or it was either of those two. And when you got down to measuring out the, you know, amount of trash that you would take out of some of the homes, it was just amazing.
It's overwhelming.
Yeah, it is. And you can see why a person would be overwhelmed with that process, because that's all their stuff. And to them, that stuff was important. And if you're, you know, shipping out 10 dumpsters full of their stuff, you know, you can see where the overwhelming nature would be. And, you know, sometimes as a viewer, and I know I've experienced this myself, you watch it and they don't seem to be grateful at the time. And your explanation earlier really helped me with that. But they don't seem to be grateful at the time. And as a viewer, sometimes you can get very aggravated because you're thinking, these people are here to help you. Why aren't you taking the help? Or why are you being rude about the help? And like I said, your explanation earlier was very, very, very enlightening. But I never really focused on this is all of, you know, 10 dumpsters full of their stuff that they've just now had to say goodbye to. And like you said, they're backed into a corner. They have no choice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think there's a couple things to keep in mind. I mean, the first thing is the show typically features two people. So in a 60-minute episode, when you add in commercials, each person is featured in 22 minutes. So for two people, it's 44 minutes plus the remaining 16 is commercials. So in 22 minutes, you are seeing 5 days of footage that has been condensed. So approximately 80 hours of footage in 22 minutes. So you're not really seeing everything. You're just getting the features that of an experience of 5 days of work, and they're trying to capture it. And, you know, I always wish that we could show more, but it's impossible because there's so many people that we want to help. The other thing to remember is if you imagine your home right now, and you're in the room that you're in, and there is three people in your bedroom, there's three people in your kitchen, and there's three people in your living room, and they are loading up items that they think are not useful. And as you peek out the room that you're in, you're seeing people going past with bags of stuff. Would you not wonder what is in those bags.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, you're
what the person's dealing with is people are bagging up their stuff and they don't know what's in it. And so when you see someone going, wait, what's in that bag? Well, that's understandable because someone else has made a decision about what they think is important or not important.
Right.
Right. I know. I think anybody would have a problem with that when you look at it from that point of view. It's like, wait, but that's mine. Where are you going
yeah.
with mine?
From?
You know, we as viewers don't see it that way. We see it as, well, that's just a bunch of garbage, and they need to get that cleared out and thrown out. But to the person that you're trying to help, that's their life.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, kudos for the compassion that you show these people, Doc, because it's amazing and heartbreaking and overwhelming all at the same time.
Well, and
absolutely.
Imagine also, I my husband and I recently had an experience that we had lost one of our car keys a long time ago. And so we were very, very intent on keeping track of the other one, which we lost last week. And so in our effort to find it, I put on some rubber gloves and went through the garbage. Because I thought, well, what if, you know, it slipped off the counter and fell into the garbage? So I went through the garbage and couldn't find it. But if you imagine you've got a crew of people coming into your house and you're that person that says, I don't have either key to my car, which means I can't drive it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So even though there may be a lot of garbage, true garbage, true trash in someone's home, in the back of their mind, that key could be anywhere in there. And so when you see them sifting through something, it's because I need to find my car key, you know. And I'm just an example of one person whose house is very orderly, but I sifted through the garbage just in case. And so, you know, that sheer terror of I don't want my car key to be thrown out, I need to go through this, is a very similar experience. They could have lost their wedding ring or something else. And to just see somebody shoveling up their stuff, literally, and putting it in a bag, they're thinking my car key or my wedding ring or my passport or some other very, very valuable thing could be in there, you know. And I've just resolved myself that I just need to go buy a new car key, but it's going to be $200. And it's worth sifting through everything to see if I could, you know, find that car key.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Yeah, it must be so rewarding when you've had a successful outcome, but so heartbreaking when you don't. Do you practice self-care to make sure it doesn't become too overwhelming for you?
It's very, very important because this is what my career is. It's working with people that are really struggling with their anxiety. And like we talked about, when the inside is poor and they're doing something because they have to, but not necessarily because they want to, and they're pushing back and they're pushing back. And I have that ability to foresee what's going to happen if they don't accept the help. It's very difficult. And so we have to make sure that we, as therapists, take care of ourselves so that we can be there for not only other patients, but also for our loved ones, and that we don't end up sort of taking that dive ourselves because we're getting overly personal with our work. It's so important that I think for any person that you can separate yourself from your work and let that be, because there are so many other components to our life that, you know, oftentimes people are not what we call mindful of the different aspects of our life, that the values that are important to us get wiped away because of different aspects of our life that overwhelm us or bleed in. So if you look at sort of your life as being a pie, you know that pie diagram where you sort of say, you know, what represents what part of my life represents work? Well, you know, if you look at the amount of work in your life, if you are working full time, you get up in the morning, by the time you have breakfast, get ready, drive to work, assuming that you're working an eight-hour shift plus an hour lunch, that's 9 hours alone, just 8 hours plus 1 hour, 9 hours. Plus, let's just give minimally, you know, probably an hour and a half for each person, and for some people it's going to be closer to 2 hours, you know, pre-work, post-work. So 9 plus 4, there's 13 hours of your day that just goes to work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you add in the next greatest part of your day-to-day, which is sleep. So if you figure conservatively 7 hours, there's 20 hours taken out of your 24-hour day. That leaves you 4 hours. You've got relationships, you've got animals, you've got errands to run, you've got your house to keep in order. So the reality is the smallest portion of your life is actually for everything outside of sleep and work. And so it's so important that any one of us really take care of ourselves so that we can be present in that smallest piece of our life that's left over, so that we're present and we're mindful and we're involved in that. Because if you're not, then, you know, you don't want to be one of those ones where when you retire, you look back and you say, well, I had a great career, but now I feel like I'm too tired to kind of reap the rewards. You know, my knees are breaking down and I'm tired every day. And so I really talk with people about the investment in the different aspects of your life that contribute to your values so that you can be mindful and present in each of those different categories.
Yeah, I kind of feel like I'm going through that now. I only work 4 days a week, but my work days are generally 12 to 13 hour long days. You know, that's not including driving to work. That's not including, getting home from work. You know, I get home, I'm lucky to get an hour and a half to hang out with Beck and with our cats, and then I end up passing out. I don't fall asleep, I pass out, and then start all over again the next day. So it's really difficult trying to find any type of work-life balance, you know, and then you want to go out. Like, I wanted to take her out last night, and, you know, just so exhausted, you're like, oh, I can't do it.
Yeah,
well,
that's why our weekends are important.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that it's important that, you know, just to back up, I had a client many, many years ago, about 20 years ago, and I'll never forget what she said to me. And that was, I work all year for 2 weeks vacation. And I thought, wow, that's like a really powerful statement. Because what is happening outside of that 8-to-5 job? You come home, and there is time in the evening, like you said, maybe an hour and a half. What are you doing in that time? Why does it have to be that Monday through Friday we work, and on the weekends, that's when our free time is? Oh, but we need to run to the store. We need to go to the dry cleaners. We need to clean the house. Like, I mean, really making a choice, a decision to have every day of your life be value-based. And you don't want to look back and say, wow, I wish that I had of, because every day can be a day where you make that choice or that decision to live in the moment and to say, you know what, I'm not going to work 13 hours today. I'm going to work 10, and I'm going to go home, and I'm going to take Beck out to dinner, because that's an important piece of my life.
Yeah.
And we can't always do that, because sometimes we have those curveballs that cause us to be at work later. But I think so oftentimes we don't realize that we do have a choice to do things differently rather than give in to what presents in front of us. You know, I'm not somebody that gives out my cell phone number to my patients. I don't text my patients, and I don't email with my patients. There is a phone number that they call, and they leave a message, you know?
Yeah.
And if I have time over a weekend that doesn't interfere with what's value-based for me on the weekend, then I will you know, take that time to give a call back. But otherwise, it's Monday through Friday. That's when I return calls, because it's important that, as you guys asked that question, that's turned into a much longer discussion. It's about taking care of yourself, you know. I mean, I'm looking out the window right now. I see my horses, you know, eating their breakfast. And so I got up this morning, had my coffee, fed the dog, fed the horses. You know, I'm having this discussion with you, and then my day is going to start. You know, I'm going to spend some time with my husband. We're going to go do some wine tasting, because I don't want to be sitting in front of my desk, you know, responding to various other emails or work-related issues. You know, life is, we've got one go-around. I don't believe we're going to come back as a rock or a turtle or, you know, some other form, you know. I believe this is
I would like
so
to
why
be an
not
otter?
Make the best out of it?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, both hoarders and hoarding buried alive brought a sense of awareness for so many. People either knew someone that was a hoarder and had no idea what it was, or they had never heard of it before. Personally, I feel that raising awareness is the first step to getting people help. Are you happy with how the show presented the disorder and showed people how painful it actually is?
I think that the show has done the very best job that they can with the constraints that they have. So as I mentioned, there's 5 days of filming, over 80 hours of footage that is condensed into 22 minutes. And so they've done the very best job that they can with what they have to work with. I think that it would be a very different experience if it was a week-long series. You know, if you imagine a show that follows a family, you know, week by week by week. And so if we have one person who's struggling with hoarding behaviors or hoarding disorder and you follow them every week, you'd see a very, very different situation than just, you know, this is them this week and that's it. You don't see them again. So they've brought a disorder to life. They've brought awareness. There are so many more people across the world, because it is a show that is featured all over the world. And it's really opened people's eyes to say, oh, my gosh, that's me. Oh, my gosh, there's help. Oh, my gosh, I don't need to feel shameful or embarrassed. This is a very real condition that I can seek help for. And that's one of the things that we've really tried to illustrate, is that it's not about shame. It's not about judgment. It's not about who you are as a person, as it is, this is a real condition that you are suffering for or with, and that there's help for it. So, you know, answer is, I think they've done a really good job to really promote awareness, and this conversation with you is about my efforts to reduce stigma, promote awareness, and to encourage people that if you are struggling, reach out. There's a wonderful organization called the International Obsessive Compulsive Foundation, in which I'm very involved with, whereby they have a provider database. It's iocdflikefrank.org, iocdf.org. And you can go to their provider database and put in your location and zip code to see if there might be someone in your area that could help. There's also many task forces that are forming to help people who might not otherwise have access to resources. And if somebody's struggling with either hoarding disorder or an anxiety disorder, I would really encourage you to access that website to see if there's somebody in your area. And certainly people can always feel free to contact me at the Anxiety Treatment Center, and that number is 916-366-0647, and go to our website as well, which is anxietytreatmentexperts.com.
I'm glad you gave all that information out, because we were going to ask you for that at the end of the show anyway. So.
Sure.
Hey, Dr. Zazio, what do you want people to understand the most about hoarding disorder?
That it is not about who you are as a person. Like any other mental health condition, it has different factors that contribute, and that it's important to uncover those factors, whether it be trauma, abuse, the reality of sort of what we call nature versus nurture. The nature part is the chemical aspects, the heredity that's contributing to the behaviors, the difficulty with resisting the acquisition of items, the difficulty with letting go, or so that's the nature, is the chemical aspects. The nurture is the environmental. You know, were you raised in an environment where you were taught that it's important not to let anything go, that it's important that you hold on to things because you never know when things will be taken away from you? So there's lots of people who have been taught to hold on. So looking at the factors that are contributing and really addressing those, because everything about getting well and living that incredibly balanced and fulfilled life that's going to be what's going to be important. And it's not just about getting rid of the stuff. It's the contributing factors. And probably equally important is for family members to understand that it's not about someone being lazy or not caring. There's something very chemical going on that's contributing. And if they could let go of the stuff, they would. So just telling them, don't worry about it, just throw it away, is not a solution. Just like someone who's feeling depressed, to tell them to just be happy. It doesn't work that way.
Think positive.
Yeah.
Think a happy thought. Exercise. Yeah. You know,
yep,
those are all great things to do, but it's not going to fix the problem.
Exactly.
Yeah. I have to ask you this one question because I've been dying to find out. I thought that I was the only person that this happened to. And, you know, Joe pointed it out to me at one point where I would sit down and start to watch an episode, and about 10 minutes in, I would pause it and I would have to go clean something. I go clean my kitchen, go empty the dishwasher, you know, whatever the case may be. And there would be times when Joe would be home and I would be watching a show and I'd pause it and I would say, okay, can you help me clean up this room? Can you help me pick all this stuff up? And I have found out that there are a lot of people that go through this. And there was even a comedian who mentioned it at one point. He said, so how long can you get to an episode of Hoarders before you got to clean your house? What are your thoughts on this? Because it's baffling to me, and it literally happens every time I watch it. I can't have things dirty around me when I'm watching it.
I don't know why some people have that reaction. I've definitely heard that many times as well. And I don't know. I don't know if it's, you know, kind of like some kind of reaction, you know, if you see, let's say you're watching something on TV and you see bugs crawling on someone and suddenly like you're, you know, brushing off your arms like the bugs are crawling on you know.
Yeah.
I can't really answer that. I know that I don't have that experience, but many people do. And it's a phenomenon that I can't explain.
Okay. But you've heard of it before, so I'm not just, you know, out there. You have heard.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I've definitely heard of that, and you know, conversely, I've also heard many, many, many stories about individuals who have watched the show and they've taken the tips and the tools, and you know, they've sat down with a notepad and started to write down all the things that they're learning. And when they're struggling themselves, you know, not just you and me who likes to clean our home, if you will, so that it's clean, but people who are really struggling to take those tips and those tools and to say, okay, I don't have access to help myself, but I can take what I'm learning, because everything about what we're trying to do is to help not just the people who are there, but the viewers as well. to be able to do what they need to do if they're struggling. And of course, I did write a book a few years ago. It's called The Hoarder in You, How to Live a Happier, Healthier, Uncluttered Life. And it's a very easy read, just packed full of tips and tools from understanding the negative thinking patterns that are contributing to the acquisition of items and the difficulty letting go, to being able to identify the aspects that are contributing to your difficulty letting go, like we've talked about, to being able to understand who you are as a person with regard to what are the best organizing strategies. So for some people, they're going to work best by, you know, working 8 hours a day and just pounding out as much as they can, versus some people who really get distracted and it's better for them to work maybe a half hour at a time or an hour at a time. So the book really helps people to walk themselves through that whole process.
I think I know what our next purchase on Amazon is.
I hope so.
Hey Doc, we love that you spent this time with us today. We have to unfortunately start wrapping things up. So, you know, we're going to end with a song from Carly Robin Green called "What Love Is All About." But if you wouldn't mind staying on the line for a couple of minutes after the song starts, we'd really appreciate it.
Yes, we've been honored to have you here with us today. And it really, you've really opened my eyes personally. I'm sure you've opened Joe's eyes and our listeners as well. You've really, really been just a fantastic guest, and we truly appreciate you.
It's my pleasure.
Awesome. Thank you. And guys, have a great and wonderful Saturday and a wonderful weekend. Thank you for taking the time to listen in. And we will see you all next week.
Yep. Have a great week, guys.
Caught me by surprise, but I
Join us next week as Rebecca and Joe continue to battle the stigma of mental illness. Follow us on Twitter at Voices for Change RJ and on Facebook at Voices for Change 2.0.